Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the overview of the MDS 3.0 webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, you may press 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any point you need to reach an operator, you may press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, October 27, 2010. I would now like to turn the call over to Lori Smetanka. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Benjamin, and welcome to all of you who have joined us this afternoon. I'm Lori Smetanka. I'm the director of the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center, and we're delighted to be able to sponsor this call for you today. We'll be talking this afternoon about the brand new, newly implemented MDS 3.0, which is part of a resident assessment tool for nursing home residents. We're delighted today to have some representatives from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services who will be joining us and giving you an overview of different sections of the MDS. First, you'll be hearing from Thomas Dudley. Tom is technical advisor with the Division of Chronic and Post-Acute Care in the Office of Clinical Standards and Quality at CMS. You'll also be hearing from John Sorensen, who is the project officer and outreach coordinator with the Money Follows the Person Rebalancing Demonstration Project at CMS, as well as his colleague, Mary Beth Rebart, who will be helping with answering questions. And in addition to Tom and John, you'll also be hearing from Sarah Hunt, who is a consultant with the Ombudsman Resource Center and who has expertise in the areas of ombudsman training, policy development, program management, and care planning. As we begin, we'll be going through presentation, and then after John, Tom and Sarah have concluded their presentations, we will open for questions and answers and take as many as we can. Handouts were sent out in advance, and they will be available on the Ombudsman Resource Center website at www.ltcombudsman.org. Please also visit the website for additional information related to the MDS 3.0 and particularly Section Q, which we'll be talking about today. There's a section on our issues page on our website where you can find a lot of the information that will be touched on today. So with that, I'm going to turn the call over to Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori, and good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity to tell everyone a little bit about MDS 3.0 this afternoon. We're very excited about this new instrument. It's 15 years overdue and getting out, and there are some exciting changes. If you're following along with the slides, I'll try to remember to give cues by moving on to slide 2. What I'm going to cover in the next few moments is go over a little bit of the MDS, or the minimum data set, and the resident assessment instrument history, the MDS 3.0, what's new about it and why the change, as well as where we are with quality measures for assessing outcomes in the nursing home population. First section here is talking about the MDS and the RAI history. And moving up to slide 4, you know, first question is, why MDS? Well, the law says we have to. If you go back to the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 87, or OBRA 87, as you often hear it mentioned, that is the statutory and regulatory basis for the resident assessment instrument. The main driving force behind this legislation was developed over concern for the care that residents were receiving in nursing homes. And the goal of the REI is to provide a comprehensive, accurate, standardized, reproducible assessment of each resident's functional capabilities, and to help the staff identify health problems so they can provide the appropriate care for each individual resident. Moving up with the different legislation, the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, or BBA of 97, that pulls in the payment side that's tied in with the MDS, or the resident assessment instrument. I'm moving on to slide 5 here, and some of the official uses for the MDS. Primary is care planning, which came into play with December 1990. Survey and certification tie-in came in same time frame. The payment and electronic submission in 1998. And I'm not sure how many people were around, but back in 2002, there was the Nursing Home Quality Initiative public reporting, where we were really promoting the outcomes that were being achieved at different facilities. It was an exciting time. It really got the public reporting aspect of patient outcomes or resident outcomes out to the public. And that was one of the first initiatives that CMS has taken into the public reporting forum. In 2002, nursing home quality was also built into the Quality Improvement Organization scope of work. Moving to slide 6, and start this off by saying, why MDS 3.0? Why are we making the change? MDS 2.0 is outdated, and outdated is a putting it nicely. It was developed 15 years ago. It was appropriate at the time, but clinical practices have changed significantly over 15 years. MDS 2.0 just wasn't consistent with the clinical practices that we see in healthcare today. And what we found with the earlier version was that it had limited value to the nursing homes outside of it being a required assessment. So why do something that doesn't have a lot of value? It's always one of those questions everyone asks. So the MDS 3.0 was developed in such a manner that it is flexible, so we can keep it current with ongoing changes in the healthcare setting to ensure nursing home residents are achieving or receiving the care that they deserve. Moving on to slide 7, I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about the new MDS 3.0. And on to slide 8. We did go live October 1 of this year. We're coming up on 1 month of operation with the MDS 3.0. We've received a number of anecdotal comments, and they've been mixed, which is not surprising. There's some good things, some bad things, some in-between things, which, you know, is expected with such a large rollout. Some of the things, positive things that we've heard are that nursing homes are getting much more valuable information from their residents during the interviews, which were added to the assessment instrument. The interviews themselves are taking less time than actually performing chart abstraction to get the information about the resident. Residents seem to appreciate the increased interaction. Probably no surprise there. The other aspect, we added a discharge assessment. So there is some adjusting that's going on with this additional assessment. Those are where some of the not-so-positive ones come in, but there are positives in doing this because it gives the nursing home an opportunity to show what good work they're doing, especially when it's tied in with public reporting. If they're doing a good job providing care and their outcomes are good, well, they should be proud of that. And if they're not achieving good outcomes, they should be doing something about it. We've also received some comments about decreasing or eliminating some of the duplication that people are seeing in the assessment instrument. Right now, CMS is more in a listening mode. We are looking at the different comments that are coming in. It hasn't even been a month yet, so once we give it the instrument a few months, we'll take a step back and see if we can or should adjust the instrument in any manner. But it's too early to say if we will or if it will be necessary to make any changes. I'm moving on to slide 9 here. What does MDS 3.0 bring to the nursing home community? Well, some of the main advances to the MDS 3.0 include pulling the resident's voice and desires into the assessment. This was one of the original intents of the MDS, is to include the resident in the assessment process. We've seen over the year that some places, some providers have gotten away from that. The resident is the center of the care. and they are the ones that are most important to the care that's being delivered in the nursing home. With the MDS 3.0, we see increased resident interactions, always a positive to actually, a novel idea, actually speaking with the residents and interacting. It gives you a better sense of how that individual is doing. Not that that's not, I know that probably came across a little sarcastic, but it wasn't intended that way, but it's, I don't think, coming from a clinical perspective, I don't think you can have too much interaction with residents, especially the nursing home population when they're separated from their families. Most people appreciate having an opportunity to socialize with people. Simply as, you know, something as simple as saying, how are you doing today? In addition, we have the increased clinical relevance, which increases the accuracy of the information that's gleaned from the assessment. And this comes into the more clinically relevant aspect of the new instrument. We, RAND did a lot of research in the development of this new instrument. It was led by Dr. Deb Salivo. She's a gerontologist, a wonderful gerontologist, a very pleasant person. And she put a lot of time and effort in developing this instrument. And it's tying in the current clinical practices, making it an excellent assessment instrument, again, to ensure that the residents achieve the best possible care. We're assessing the outcomes. It increases the clarity of the information that's collected in the assessment instrument. And the final comment here, we are expecting a reduction in completion times. During the testing that RAND did, they saw a decrease by 45% in the completion time of the assessment. That's probably not an accurate number at this point. There were modifications made to the instrument after this testing was done. And it's early. There's a learning curve with any new instrument. So probably by the beginning of next year, we'll have a better sense on how the time factor plays into using the actual instrument. But we do anticipate that it would be slightly shorter. The number of items captured are pretty consistent. Moving on with slide 10, you know, continuing with the same theme, this is a little redundant because I'm saying again here, it's better match the clinical practices, and most importantly, a big section that we focused on was on the pressure ulcer assessment and making sure we're looking at pressure ulcers from the proper perspective and ensure that they're improving or, you know, going away in a timely manner, or more importantly, being prevented from occurring in the first place. And what you'll be hearing from CMS in the upcoming years is more of a focus not just on nursing homes, not just on hospitals or dialysis facilities or home health. We're looking at the care that's being delivered across the whole continuum. And if you might think of it somewhat as accountability. So if we get better information, the different health settings, and the data transfers around, we can see where the where hiccups may be occurring or areas for improvement exist. One of the exciting aspects of this instrument is that we've included the enhanced assessment of behavioral, depression, and cognitive function, and these are where the interview elements come into play. Over the years, depression, which is very prevalent, has been underreported or underdiagnosed, especially in the nursing home population. And we're finding with the new interview techniques, should be more, we should be able to elicit more valuable information so that residents are treated appropriately if they do are exhibiting signs of depression. And next, moving on to the quality measures. Quality of care is a major important. That's an area that I specifically work on. here at CMS with the quality measures. We look at the outcomes of patients both in a short stay as well as a long stay perspective. With regards to the nursing home compare site, hopefully most of you are familiar with, the last update using the MDS 2.0 data will occur in January of next year. In April of next year, the quality measure data will be removed from the five-star calculations, as well as the quality measure data will be pulled down off of the nursing home compare website. We anticipate that the quality measure data will return to nursing home compare as sometime in the spring of 2012. We haven't had a chance to look at the new MDS 3.0 data yet, but based on experience with new data sources and having enough data to publicly report, we're pretty confident about the spring of 2012 date. We are in the process of having new measures endorsed by the National Quality Forum. The Nursing Home Quality Forum Steering Committee recommended 17 measures for endorsement. If you visit the National Quality Forum website, they have all the measures specifications listed. The NQF member vote is running until the 16th of November, and we're expecting final endorsement in December of this year. Primarily the quality measures that are being are going through the endorsement process right now are many of the same measures that are mapped from to the new MDS 3.0 instrument. Measure development is not a static process. This is step one, and we will, in 2011, we'll be developing additional new quality measures to really, our goal is to push the quality of care upward to ensure that all residents receive appropriate care. We've seen a lot of positive progress, especially in the use of physical restraints. Everyone said you can't get the number down, but the number is way down from where it was 7 years ago. But there is, it is manageable, and it just takes a little focus. And Lori, that's what I have at this point. I'll save the rest for questions that come in. The dialogue would be good, and I look forward to the questions.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate your presentation. And just a reminder that the slides that Tom was referencing were sent out to those who had registered in advance, and they will also be included with the conference call materials and the recording on the Ombudsman Resource Center website afterwards. Next, we'll turn to John Sorensen, who's also with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And John's going to be focusing on one particular section of the MDS 3.0, Section Q, talking about why, what changes were made to Section Q and why it's so important that we're focusing on that. So, John, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Lori. I'm sorry that folks on the call haven't received previously the slides that I prepared, but I have sent them to Lori, and she'll post them on the website after the call with the recording from today's call as well. My presentation is, as Lori indicated, on Section Q of the new MDS 3.0. This section is entitled Participation in Assessment and Goal Setting. And first, let me give you a little bit of little discussion on the changes from 2.0 to 3.0 of Section Q. The discharge potential item under MDS 2.0 asked an assessor, basically a facility staff who was performing the MDS administration, if a resident in a facility had expressed a preference to return to the community, and then was documented in the assessor's opinion whether the individual had made the indication or not. Now under MDS 3.0, the individual is asked personally if they're interested in speaking with someone about the possibility of returning to the community. So this as Tom mentioned, is another interview component that has been added to MDS 3.0 in an effort to increase the resident's voice in the assessment rather than just merely that of an assessor who's performing the survey. Under 2.0, an assessor's findings were recorded in a database on Section Q, and there was not a requirement for follow-up. Now, under 3.0, if an individual responds yes, that they would like to speak to someone about returning to the community, the facility must initiate care planning and may refer an individual to a state-designated, what's referred to as a local contact agency. So, in other words, there's now a requirement for a follow-up if an individual gives a positive response. Under 2.0, a resident asked the assessor if a resident has a support person who's positive towards discharge. Now, under 3.0, there is a more extensive series of questions for assessment and investigation for care planning, and it's not necessary that an individual have a family member or someone other than themselves that are positive towards discharge. In other words, we're not stopping a discharge possibility because an individual doesn't have somebody else who agrees that discharge is a good idea. Under 2.0, the question was only administered upon admission and annually, and this really we found didn't give very current accurate data. So we've now under MDS 3.0, the question is administered upon admission and annually, but also now quarterly and upon significant change in the individual's condition. Section Q increases resident voice and promotes collaboration to meaningfully engage the resident in their discharge planning goals. It directly asks the resident if they want information about long-term care community-based options, promotes linkages and information exchange between nursing homes, local contact agencies, and community-based long-term care providers. There's a real emphasis under 3.0 now to encourage new collaborative relationships, and I'll discuss that a little bit more in a moment. And 3.0 promotes discharge planning collaboration between the nursing homes, local contact agencies, and the residents who may require medical and supportive services. Okay. Nursing home staff, I'm going to discuss the collaboration piece a little more now. Nursing home staff are expected to contact a local contact agency, which has been designated by the state Medicaid office, for those residents who express a desire to learn about possible transition. Local contact agencies are then expected to respond to the nursing home staff referrals by providing information to the residents about available community-based long-term care services. And the nursing home staff and the local contact agencies together are expected to meaningfully engage the resident in their potential discharge and transition planning and collaboratively work to arrange for all the necessary community-based long-term care services to be provided that the individual may need. Nursing homes are still expected to do discharge planning. I did receive a question during a previous presentation about does this mean now that the local contact agency will be doing the discharge planning? No, it's still a job of the nursing facility. Local contact agencies, who are they? A local contact agency can be a Center for Independent Living, a AAA, an Area Agency on Aging, an Aging and Disability Resource Center, a Money Follows the Person program in states where those are, a Developmental Disability Administration, for instance, for folks with a PASAR Level 2 assessment of DD in nursing facilities or an ICFMR, and could be a mental health administration or any mix of these that the state has designated as local contact agency. We are working to encourage MFP states to be a link for their state Section Q implementation. Currently, we have 29 states and the District of Columbia are MFP grantees. And we recently issued a new solicitation because the MFP program has been extended for an additional 5 years. And we've issued a solicitation and received a letter of intent to apply from 15 additional states. So if all those states are awarded, then the MFP program will be present in 45 states, including the District of Columbia, and that is a transition vehicle and a funding mechanism to help support institutional transition to community-based settings. And that's all I have. I'd be glad to take questions.
Okay. Thanks so much, John, for your presentation. And Melissa actually just sent out a copy of John's outline that he put on slides to those of you who were registered for the call, and those, again, will be posted to our website afterwards. So thank you, John, for sending those. Next, we're going to turn to Sarah Hunt, who's a consultant with the Office and Resource Center, who has recently prepared an informational brief for Long-Term Care Ombudsman on the changes from the MDS 2.0 to the MDS 3.0. And she's going to go over, from the Ombudsman's perspective, what are some things that will pertain to the work that you're doing on behalf of residents. Sarah?
Thank you, Lori. I would encourage you, everyone on the call, to take a look at the information brief, which is on the Resource Center's website, and many of you have already received it by email. I'm going to hit a few of the key tips for Ombudsman, but I'm not going to go over everything that's in that brief. I hope that you'll find it useful and maybe a useful tool for sharing with other Ombudsmen, either staff or volunteers. One of the key things that I wanted to call to your attention is to kind of echo what John and Tom have said. This is an excellent opportunity to really take a fresh look at resident assessment, and I think in particular care planning and resident and family involvement and participation in truly making the care planning tool individualized and something that's actually related to care and implemented in facilities. So this is a renewed emphasis, but also really does have a lot more resident input in the assessment process itself. One of the first things that I would encourage Ombudsman to do is to take a look at the video on interviewing vulnerable elders, which CMS produced as a training video to help guide facility staff in knowing how to use the different direct resident interview tools that are part of the MDS 3. And in the information brief, as well as an additional place on the Resource Center website, you have information about how to order a DVD of that interviewing tools video, as well as to directly link to it on YouTube. Some ombudsman programs have been using it in training ombudsmen. The interviewing techniques are generic, good interviewing techniques, whether it's an ombudsman working on a concern or a problem expressed, or in this case, specific to nursing home staff gathering information for a specific part of the assessment process. Nevertheless, I think watching that will give you a much better idea about how residents are being asked to share information and give input into the assessment process, as well as how staff are being asked to sit down and really have a meaningful conversation with residents in a way that's not rushed, but they still are using an instrument that has some validation through a research process, and the questions and answers are standardized. Another section or opportunity that I think would be very beneficial for ombudsmen is to use this whole changeover in the assessment process to encourage residents and families to be prepared to participate in the assessment process. We've had tools and information sheets, consumer information sheets, on the website and on the Consumer Voice website for a while, but it's a time to drag that information out, brush it off, and have a renewed emphasis on consumer participation in essentially establishing their goals and patterns for care and what's significant about their daily life and preferences. One of the things that I think would be very beneficial for ombudsmen to be aware of as well is for residents who have participated in a review or an update or a new assessment, resident assessment process, the comprehensive piece. The section on customary daily routines and resident activities and preferences has been significantly changed in version 3.0. There are some choices given to residents to try to determine how important different activities and daily routines are in their lives and choices. On the one hand, I think having this information in a different way in 3.0 really increases the likelihood that facilities will use it and begin to build the resident preferences into the daily routines and how care is delivered to a resident and quality of life. On the other hand, I think some of the questions being asked and the way residents are asked to respond to how important a range of things are to them may leave a resident with the idea that maybe they can't choose in all of these areas, or they may not be able to change their mind later on, or if something's very important, then maybe they'll get the sense that they should rank some of the other things as not so important. So I think for the ombudsman to be listening to how residents talk about their activities and the choices that they can make and the routines and their preferences is really important. To go along with that, I think ombudsman can use this as an opportunity to maybe sit down with resident councils or family councils, of course, at the request of those councils, and just talk with them about this changeover in questions asked on the assessment and resident direct participation and involvement and how that connects with care planning, and talk with them about the residents' rights to have accommodation of their needs and preferences. Have them start thinking about some of those things and the whole range of preferences and the opportunity to change their minds and to have dialogue with facility staff at any point in time about what residents would really like or changes that they would like to have made, not just at the time of an assessment or a review of the assessment. So just have your antenna up for things that you may hear that kind of set off a buzz or that are different than what you used to hear, as well as think about how you can help residents and families really understand what to be prepared for and the full range of their rights and ability to really have conversations with facility staff at any point in time. The Section Q information, Lori is working on a piece for Ombudsman that you'll receive soon, and I would expect there will be a number of questions, so I'm going to move on. There's a little bit of information in the information brief for Ombudsman on changes in the 3.0 on Section Q, as well as a number of resources already up on the Ombudsman Resource Center website. With care planning, I've talked a little bit about this. Just the change just gives you another opportunity to go in and say, oh, there's change. Let's sit down and talk about this. Some of the information that we already have up on the website that maybe use examples and terminology from the MDS 2.0, the principles about how people prepare for care planning and participate and the role of the resident or family member in participating in their care planning and how the language needs to be in a way that everyone can understand. All of that information is still current and still accurate. So take a look at those resources and adapt them if you wish, but use this as a renewed opportunity to focus on empowering residents to participate in their care. There are a number of resources given in this information brief. There are links to the website. The resources have to do with ones that the Resource Center has produced specific to ombudsmen and advocates, as well as the resources that CMS has. And I think the last thing I'd like to do before I turn it over to you, Lori, to ask for questions and have dialogue is just to encourage people to really take a look at the resource materials that CMS has developed. The training materials they have, I think, are excellent. They will answer a lot of your questions. The information and instructions, the huge thick manual that you may hear some providers talk about, it is large, but you can use a search. It explains a lot of information. They're excellent examples. So if there are areas that you really want to know more, I think the information is available. But I would encourage you all to begin with the video on interviewing your vulnerable elders, if you haven't already seen that, to just help you get a concrete idea about what facilities staff are being asked to do and the kinds of conversations and adjustments to residents' abilities to speak and communicate that staff are asked to make so that residents really can have a meaningful conversation with staff about what they want and what they need and what's important to them. So it's a great opportunity. We'd like for you to keep us informed about how you, Ombudsman, are using materials, what you're coming across, and ways that you develop your own materials. If you'll share those with us, we'll be able to share those with other people. Lori?
Great. Thank you so much, Sarah. And thanks, all three of you, for your excellent presentations this afternoon. As Sarah mentioned, one of the other resources that we're working on right now for Ombudsman is a fact sheet on Section Q. And that fact sheet, which will be coming in probably the next week or so, will cover some of the things that John had mentioned in his presentation this afternoon, some of the highlights about what's expected under Section Q. But it's also including a part related to Ombudsman involvement and how you as Ombudsman would be assisting the residents. And that's actually a question that we're getting quite a bit. And I just wanted to hit five areas of Ombudsman involvement, particularly related to assisting the resident with nursing home transition, as I'm sure some of the questions will relate to it, and we'll address those, and then we'll open it up for questions. But five major activities of Ombudsman involvement related to Section Q, particularly, but the MDS, certainly would relate to investigation and resolution of resident complaints about transitions to the community, supporting the residents in their decision-making related to transitions, providing information to consumers and providers about residents' rights and options, providing educational sessions and materials to consumers about residents' rights and options, and the fifth is helping to identify candidates for transitioning to community living and making referrals as appropriate. So as I mentioned, this fact sheet will be coming out within the next week or so. So with that, Benjamin, who is assisting us as our operator this afternoon, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register for a question, you may press 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has already been answered and you'd like to withdraw your question, you may press 1 followed by the 3. One moment, please, for our first question.
Great. As we're waiting for the first question to come in, one that I'm hearing a lot that I'm hoping maybe Tom can address is, Tom, can you tell us how facilities have been trained in the use of the MDS 3.0?
Certainly. There have been numerous training opportunities that have been offered. Actually, CMS provided two national training opportunities that were attended by roughly 1,000 each time. One in Baltimore and one in Las Vegas in April and August, respectively. A number of organizations in the nursing home community have also been doing training seminars. The state survey agencies have been helping to train. And, of course, we have all the materials that were used in the training. The face-to-face training is available. Even the presentations are available on YouTube. The actual presentations from the August training are included. So it's accessible, ongoing, so everyone can hear the same information. And since we're talking about the training, I want to take an opportunity to mention my colleague, Stacy Mandel, is listening in on the call, and she was the force behind the development of these training materials and these training conferences. And without her hard work and dedication, that we wouldn't have all these wonderful materials.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Benjamin, can we have the first question?
Our first question comes from the line of Diane Brookins. Please go ahead. Your line is now open for questions.
Thank you so much. The question I have is, who is responsible in the skilled nursing facilities for completing the 3.0?
As far as the completion of the whole instrument or any specific section?
The whole instrument, is it divided up as they did with the 2.0, or is
it can be divided up. A lot of that depends on the practices of the nursing home and state laws as far as who is qualified to complete the different sections. But typically, it is someone who is actually doing the providing the care in an area. You would probably have a nurse and a physician for the pressure ulcer section. You would have a occupational therapist or physical therapist that would be doing the actual therapy sections. But it can vary from facility to facility because it should be a multidisciplinary approach. It shouldn't just be one person's perspective, but I can't definitively say that goes across the board.
I was in a facility yesterday, and that's why I'm asking the question.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It can vary, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Diane. Benjamin, do we have another question?
Yes, we do. Our next question comes from the line of Mark Miller. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Good afternoon. This is Mark Miller with Ombudsman Program in New York. And I think my question is for John. John, in New York, the Department of Health has designated the Money Follows the Person grantees as the local contact agencies. And a letter has gone out to all the nursing home administrators that says, if it's determined to be feasible and the resident expresses an interest in returning to the community, then they have to make the referral within 10 days to the to one of the local contact agencies. So my question, though, is around that qualifier of if it's determined to be feasible. Who's making that determination?
Yeah, this is John. We've identified maybe an issue with the skip pattern within the new Section Q, and there is an indication that the nursing facility can mark someone as discharge determined to be not feasible. And we're intending to address that when we are making some potential revisions to the instrument early next year. We're currently having discussions regarding that right now, because at this time, the nursing facility can still mark that as discharge determined to be not feasible, and we don't necessarily want them to always have
Right. Just seems to me, if they were getting pressure, for instance, from a family that says, you know, we're going to sell the home, we're not going to bring someone back, and the facility is just going to then check off, well, it's not feasible, even though the resident truly does want to return home and perhaps could with support.
Right, and hopefully through some of the trainings some of the outreach and education efforts we have underway, staff will learn to think beyond what they're customarily done in the past. Anyway, you understand what I'm saying.
Obviously, you're aware of our fear.
For staff to think differently, that just because the individual's home isn't available doesn't mean they can't be discharged to another home.
Right.
And that services in the community are more robust than they were at one time.
Right.
But we are hoping to address that issue with revisions that will hopefully be done early next year.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, and this is Mary Beth Rebar. I have a question, and John's absolutely right. I mean, our concern, and we're trying to address this. The facility should not be making a decision and then deciding to make or not make the referral. They should see if the resident wants to learn more information. And if the resident wants to learn more information, the local contact agency can help the facility and the resident with what's available in the community in the way of supports and services. So it seems like the letter, the way it's stated, has reversed things a little bit. I like John just said, what criteria, what facts, what observations is the facility using to make the decision that it's not feasible for this individual to get information about the possibility and what is available in the community? So I'm just bringing that up for discussion and thought. I don't know how you in New York work around that. It may be that, have they already sent out the letter?
Mark's line might not be open.
I think you said that the letter has been sent, so fair enough.
The letter was sent in September. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear. If there can be some follow-up clarification or guidance in relation to like what the intent was. I mean, one of the things John and I are hearing, we're hearing a variety of things. One is that in some states, everyone's being referred, even people who come in for short-term rehab, and that's not practical or appropriate, and the Section Q items are not set up like that. On the flip side, we have facilities who are deciding to just check. It's not feasible for anyone they think that just has a high acuity needs and multiple medical issues, and they've just decided that this is impossible. So
before they speak with the resident to find out what their desire is. Right.
So, you know, when this all got rolled out and implemented, we really stressed with the states and, you know, all the stakeholders that you need to look at this in a practical way and set up processes and procedures and communication mechanisms that make sense. Of course, we don't want everyone referred if they're in for a two-week or a month rehab stay and they have a home to go to and their spouse is there. That's not an appropriate referral to the local contact agency. But like John said, you know, the flip side of that is that there may be some people that the nursing facility feels like or senses that, you know, they just, they won't be able to do this or the supports aren't there. I'm just raising awareness and questioning how can the facility make all those determinations without at least talking to the local contact agent to see what is available or not. So, you know, we'll be working on this and hearing from states and facilities and stakeholders about how it's going and what the issues are, but we will work to, as John said, we're going to address the items in Section Q and test that to look at this feasibility determination issue. And but we really welcome and look to all of you as well as all the stakeholders, the nursing facilities, the clinicians, everyone, to tell us what's working and what's not working with this and what's practical or not and how can we improve either the wording of the questions and the items or the implementation of it. But thank you very much for that question.
Great, thank you. Benjamin, do we have another question in queue?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Benson Nadell. Please go ahead, your line is now open.
This is Benson Nadell, Ombudsman Program in San Francisco, California. And this has to do with some of the implications of implementing Section Q, specifically for those people on Medicaid share of cost in California, Medi-Cal share of cost. Typically what happens after the first 3 months, people then have a liability or a contribution, which is called their share of cost. And at least in San Francisco, which has a lot of apartments and supportive housing, it's very difficult for individuals who've given up their living unit to return to the community without having some money to invest in finding a new living unit. So I'm asking whether this policy around Section Q is going to ramify into adjusting the share of cost requirements for people who are on Medicaid or Medi-Cal in California, so that maybe they can go to zero share of cost if it's triggered by certain responses in Section Q, so they have some money to work with when they are returning to the community. That's my question.
Gosh, I don't know where to begin with that.
Well, let me start off by, if the individual is transitioned under the MFP program, their services are covered under the MFP program for the first 365 days in the community. So the individual should not have any contribution necessary. Now, I have to add that my understanding is that states, and I've not heard this before, but my understanding is that states are not, individuals are not supposed to contribute to the cost of their Medicaid services, that it's federal regulations that you can't have a cost sharing other than, you know, a nominal copay or some such under a managed care program.
Well, what happens in California, and I think it's happening in other states, is that residents get to keep $35, in Kansas it's $50 personal needs allowance, and all their other income
goes towards
supplementing the Medicaid rate. So, for instance, if someone has $2,000 a month income, that pays those days at the Medicaid-approved Medicaid rate. So basically they're locked in because they don't have access to that liability. And that's set by Medicaid policy and not by the facility.
Right. Medicaid does, when an individual is in a facility,
right,
permit an individual to have a small amount of income remaining from their Medicaid benefit, from their Social Security benefit, or, you know, basically a cost of living amount. But once an individual is discharged, as long as they're on Medicaid, they still have to maintain Medicaid eligibility as far as income and assets, et cetera. But they can receive the full amount of their check once they're discharged, not just reduced to $30, they should go back to their full SSI or SSDI benefit.
But there's no planning period with this process where people can start banking some money for first and last deposits for utilities.
Part of the MFP program can cover home setup expenses, can cover security deposits, can cover setting up a pantry, furniture, that sort of thing under the MFP program.
It's dependent on which states have the MFP program.
Well, and what sort of waiver services are available, because even outside of the MFP program, it is a transition expenses are covered under certain waiver programs, and those include the home setup and the security deposits and those sorts of things that I mentioned. They're provided under MFP because they're a waiver service. So a state does not have to have an MFP program, but if they have those functions in their waiver program, they can provide them.
Can you talk more about
them, they can add them.
Okay, so the criteria for the waiver program are going to be basically SNF criteria to become eligible rather than someone who has improved and just has assistance with ADLs.
Well, I believe you have to meet a nursing facility level of care to participate in waiver services. I believe. I may be wrong on that. Mary Beth may have more information.
Most of these, as everyone knows, meeting that institutional level care needs is what kind of precipitated one of the reasons why that person was admitted to the nursing facility. When they come out, because they've been admitted to the nursing facility meeting that institutional level of care need, they will need it for the waiver. Also, we are having some situations, grantees are telling us people improve, and then when they come out of the institution, they don't meet that level of care need again for maybe a particular waiver. But the state can still use their state plan services. They can use other programs. it's a little bit of a, I don't want to use the word catch-22, but it is an issue. I wanted to ask one thing that you brought up, too, about it's the housing issue. We know that housing continues to be a major challenge, and CMS and HUD have been working together to address that, and there's more vouchers that people can apply for and a variety of activities going on. And if that is the only thing holding up the person's transition back to the community, that's a local, state, you know, how they're utilizing their vouchers. I mean, a whole host of issues. And, of course, as we know, Medicaid can't pay for the housing component, except for what John talked about, we guys have already discussed, you know, the startup as transition services. But, so we know that's an issue, and we're trying to do as much from the federal level as we can to address it.
Okay. Thanks, Benson, for that question. And
thank you.
To John and Mary Beth. And I'm sure that this is probably an issue that we could do a whole call on, just this issue. Moving on, Benjamin, do we have other questions in the queue for right now? And this question that Benson had raised about payment for home and community-based services is maybe something we'll look at doing separately.
We do have one more question from the line of Susan Ziebelblatt. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
This is Susan, Ombudsman Program, Sonoma County, California. And we are finding a trend that a lot of skilled nursing facilities are going into a rehab mode rather than long-term care of residents. And so I wondered, in analyzing the impact of Section Q, will there be a tracking system to determine if there's any correlation between the actual discharges that happen and the folks who are on Medicaid?
Well, this is Mary Beth. We have been thinking about what kind of reports, what kind of data to look at, you know, where we could get that data. And we do have some mechanisms within CMS to look at what's happening with Section Q and, you know, the type of facility. But we are in the thinking stage with that. We could, and Tom, please jump in here. From my understanding, we can get a report run through our Division of National Systems on things such as, like, how many people said yes to they want to talk to someone, how many people, was a referral made. I believe with that we could also get the, I don't know if we could, this is the part I don't know. I don't know if we can link that to, is the facility, we just get if it's Medicaid and or Medicare certified and or both, which most facilities are, but I don't know enough to answer the question if we're going to be able to get at that information easily.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm still there.
My question is not the certification of the facility, but that we sometimes wonder if discharges from skilled nursing facilities may be more motivated to get rid of somebody who's on Medicaid so they can put in a private paying patient or resident in that facility,
yeah.
And we wouldn't want Section Q to sort of be cherry-picking those folks that a facility may want to get rid of. Based on that.
Right, and we have heard anecdotally that can happen, and through the Money Files the Person program that for some nursing facilities in isolated areas, you know, they view the program as an opportunity to get, I hate to use the word, to discharge residents who may be problematic or that, you know, is difficult to care for or and the payment source or that kind of thing. Time will tell. I mean, you know, we, again, this is another area which we are going to have to some extent rely on those the money files of personal grantees, our stakeholders in the nursing home provider community, the ombudsman, to tell us if there are issues like this coming up in the field. Because we can assess that here readily. We need to hear from you what issues are coming up and what you're seeing, and also the extent of those issues. So, again, we would welcome, and we do welcome, anything that you can, you know, talk with either the state Medicaid agency or the Money Files a Person program or whoever is running, you know, the local contact agency, whatever is happening with this utilizing Section Q to get things resolved and looked at. But, yeah, that is an issue, and we've heard anecdotally that that can happen. I don't have, we don't have data to speak to that, though.
Thanks, Mary Beth and Susan. Benjamin, do we have other questions in queue?
We do have another question. It comes from the line of Debbie Lee. Please go ahead with your question.
Taking time to help clarify all these issues that are new and kind of scary for everyone. I have a follow-up question to the last one and one of my own. The follow-up is, what is the regulatory outcome for noncompliance with Section Q? How will it be evaluated? And then I'll ask my other one after that.
Okay, this is Mary Beth Rebor again. Currently, there is no discrete or distinct task in the long-term care survey process to look at this, either in the computerized survey process that is in the process of being implemented over the next 2 years throughout the states, or the paper process that we've had and some states are still doing. However, nursing facilities and skilled nursing facilities have always been held to the regulation that they do person-centered care planning based on the MDS assessment information, that they do discharge planning, again, with the resident input and choices and needs being considered, et cetera. What we said in training was that if the surveyor sees on survey that either they hear from residents when they talk to the resident council, or a resident comes up to them, or the ombudsman finds that, you know, people have asked for a referral and then no one came talk to them, or the referral was made and the contact agency came and then nothing happened. So we don't have any regulatory authority or mechanism on the local contact agency side right now. We will be collecting information, however, through our Aging and Disability Resource Center grant program and the Money Files a Person grant program to see what is happening with Section Q and the challenges and issues and how they're being addressed. On the nursing home side, if a surveyor sees that there is a FTAG, and I can't remember the name of it, but the FTAG says, the regulation says that the information that is acquired on the assessment by the assessment instrument then is to be used to do care planning. So if information is obtained from the resident on Section Q and they either want to talk to someone or they want a referral made or they want to be discharged and there's nothing happening, the surveyors, if they see that happening while they're on site or come upon that information, they have an FTAG that they can use to cite the nursing facility or skilled nursing facility for not doing care planning as it needs to be done and discharge planning. So that's really the only regulatory kind of requirement, if you want to call it stick, that's out there right now. Again, in the training and with the stakeholders and the different meetings that CMS has attended and presented at, as well as involving the Ombudsman Program and NICNR, we have, you know, we want to work with the Ombudsman, and we consider the Ombudsman, again, our eyes and ears to tell us what's happening with this. If you hear something, and or the survey team, when the survey team's on site, if there's something that you're concerned with, or is there an issue that you've talked to the nursing facility about, and nothing seems to be happening or whatever, then you can talk to that, you know, the survey team while they're on site and tell them what you see or heard or whatever for them to investigate like they would any other issue that comes up during the survey process. Because even though the survey process has distinct tasks and activities and the computerized version is more driven from the patient population and the care needs of the individuals in that facility, the survey team is held accountable to investigate anything that comes up that has needs to be looked at, you know, and is regulated under the nursing home regulations, et cetera. So that's what we have right now.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. My question is, it sounds as if there's a huge emphasis on the money follows the person grant to absorb a large portion of those individuals who may indicate a preference to return to the community. What is the expectation that there will be sufficient case management for those individuals? Because it was stated earlier that whether or not the family was on board or even for those individuals who have no family support, one of the community alternative or CAP in our area criteria for individuals who take advantage of the money follows the person is not only that they meet skilled requirement, but that they have a support system in place. So what about those individuals who lack that?
Well, basically, the Money Follows a Person program, as well as the ADR, Aging Disability Resource Center grant program, provides a lot of support to the state Medicaid agency to do diversion and transition work, especially the transition piece in this case. For the Money Follows a Person grantees, we currently have 30 states. Right, John? It's 30, yeah, 30 states, and we have another
29 14 states in the district. Right.
That's right, 29 states in the District of Columbia. We have 14 other states in the territory who plan to come on in with an application or operational protocol to come into the Money Follows a Person program in January. So we will be up to 43 states in the district and the territory. I mean, we're getting close to a national program. And Money Follows a Person program provides two things. One is it provides an enhanced federal match that pays for all the care of that individual when they leave the institution for their whole first year out in the community. So if someone is going into a waiver program or receiving state plan services, the Money Follows a Person program pays for, in some cases, 90% of that care for support and services. In addition, under the MFP program, the states have, the grantees have the ability, and many have submitted proposals and gotten the approval from CMS for what we're calling 100% administratively funded activities and positions. And what that means is they can hire someone to help implement this program for the duration of the Money Follows a Person program. And everything from transition coordinators to it's like the sky's the limit. As long as they can demonstrate to CMS that those positions and or activities will help them meet the primary goals of the Money Follows the Person program and the benchmarks that they're held accountable to move individuals out of institutions and also increase their long-term care spending in the area of community care. So the states have a lot of resources to do this if they're a grantee. And as I said, they have the enhanced funding for that person for a year, but they have the administrative part of the funding through the duration of the MFP program, which has been extended through the revision of the 2005 or 6 DRA this year, and it's going to run through 2018. I mean, they'll be moving people out of the institution until 2018, and the funds will be available. Now, what it doesn't get to is once that person finishes that year in the community, now they're in a waiver program. So, or they're getting state plan services, or however the state has put together a package for that individual. Then the state has to have that waiver, you want to call it slot, funding to care for that person ongoing in that waiver program. What we found from past experience we're finding with this program is that the first year is when that individual needs the most care and support and assistance. And often, after that first year, their level of need and the intensity of support and services will often go down. And they can then, you know, be provided services and a waiver for less money than it costs to care for that individual in the institution. So in the long run, it saves the state money, as well as provide a, you know, choice and preference and quality of life and community exclusion, et cetera. So,
and I'm just suggesting, like the gentleman from California, that there may be state-specific barriers that are in place, like the Medicaid match in California, that North Carolina's money follows the person requires a person to have a support family member. So for individuals with no family members, they're automatically not eligible.
Well, one of the things that we have encouraged, and we will be working with the MFP grantees even more, is we're looking at this program to be a change agent and to affect the Medicaid delivery care system in long-term care, and to provide the mechanism for this program to be the synergy for the program to go to the legislators and say, hey, we have this in our waiver. We need to take it away. It's keeping people in the institution. It's costing you more money, costing the taxpayers more money, and people want to be able to live in the setting of their choice with the supports that they need. But things like that, just like you said, the state has to work through those, and we are really looking for the Money Follows the Person program to be the synergy and the change agent for the state to start to work on some of these issues in their waivers.
Thank you.
And a lot of it has to come from advocates, though, too. I mean, the advocate community, the provider community, everyone has to work together and really kind of try to push the envelope on this.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thanks, Mary Beth, and thanks, Debbie. And I think we're at the point where we could probably address this issue also for a whole other call, and I think we're going to have to close the call with that question. If those of you who had additional questions were not able to ask them, if you can send them to either myself or Melissa Lake Spencer on our staff by email, we will forward them to John, Tom, and Mary Beth and ask for their assistance in responding to them, and then we'll forward the answers on out to the rest of you and also make them available on our website. I want to thank today Tom Dudley, John Sorensen, Mary Beth Rebar, and Sarah Hunt for taking the time out to provide the information that they went over this afternoon on this really important topic. We at the Ombudsman Resource Center will be doing a lot more work on this issue over the next several months. There's a bunch of material up on the website already. We're linking to the CMS website so that you have access to all of the materials that they've made available there. And we will continue to raise the questions that you bring to us with CMS so that we can get the answers as we best can to you in a timely fashion. We're also working with the Administration on Aging and the Director of Long-Term Care Ombudsman Programs, Becky Kurtz, on this issue are working on capturing information about how the implementation of the MDS and Section Q in particular is going to be impacting the work of ombudsmen across the country. And your state ombudsmen have been notified that they'll begin receiving periodic questionnaires asking for how this is impacting local ombudsman work and state ombudsman work, and we'll be asking you directly for that information. So with that, I'm going to close the call. I want to thank all of you for participating today. A recording will be posted on the website, and have a good rest of the afternoon.
Yes, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Lori.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.
Thank you. Bye-bye.